the glycemic index, a measure of how quickly glucose, sugar, from a food gets into your blood. A low GI diet has been touted as being good for your heart, your weight, and your diabetes risk because it places less of a strain on your pancreas. But a recent study has found that if anything, there might be a little added risk. One of the lead researchers was Dr. Larry Apple at Johns Hopkins University Medical Center in Baltimore, who specializes in testing diets.
Previously, we had done three major feeding studies. By feeding studies, I mean studies in which we provide everything that a person eats and drinks for a fairly long period of time. Some of our studies have lasted up to a half a year. So our first study was DASH, Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, that identified an overall dietary pattern that was helpful in terms of lowering blood pressure and cardiovascular risk. Then we did a study.
Which was a diet low in salt and high in fruit and vegetables.
Actually, it tested attributes of diet other than salt. So salt was held constant, but the diet that was most effective was a diet that was rich in fruits and vegetables, low-fat dairy products, and reduced in saturated fat. Then we did a second study that addressed the issue you brought up, Norman, which was the effects of salt on blood pressure. In that, we did a dose response study, and the lower the sodium intake, the lower the blood pressure. Then we did a third study where we said, okay, well, those diets, the DASH diet is relatively high in carbohydrate. What if we reduced some of the carbohydrate and replaced it with protein or unsaturated fat, mostly monounsaturated fat that you would get from like olive oil, for example, looking for the optimal diet to lower blood pressure, because blood pressure is such a powerful risk factor for heart disease and stroke. The diets that were higher in protein and higher in monounsaturated fat had slightly better reduction than the original DASH diet, but not so much that you would say we should change our guidelines. It basically said, you know, if people reduce their saturated fat, they can replace it with carbohydrate, unsaturated fat, or protein, which is a good message, you know, that gives people flexibility. Then our fourth study is the OmniCarb study. That was a study to look at the effects of glycemic index on cardiovascular risk factors. And so the idea was to say, okay, people have been espousing a low glycemic index diet is helpful. Typically, in terms of heart disease, what you see are signals related to LDL cholesterol, blood pressure. And to our surprise, there really were no major effects of the low glycemic index diets on risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So if you were a participant in our study, you would have been randomized to a sequence of four different diets. So one,
you were your own control because you went through all four diets
right,
yourself.
So you could compare your effects on one diet to your effects on the other diet. So here are the four diets. One is high carbohydrate, high glycemic index. That's what we said was our sort of control diet. Then high carbohydrate, low glycemic index. Those are carbohydrates that take a bit more time to get into the bloodstream and you avoid large fluctuations. Then the third diet was low carbohydrate, high glycemic index. And the fourth, and the one that we thought would be the best, would be low carbohydrate, low glycemic index. Okay? So we are really interested in the control versus that one. Now, each of those diets, by the way, were fed for 5 weeks. People consumed all 5 weeks of the diet, and then we measured very rigorously, you know, the risk factors, lipids, blood pressure. We measured insulin resistance as well. And we really did not see any benefit from the diet that was low in glycemic index.
And wasn't there a bit of harm from one of the diets?
I was agnostic on this one. I wasn't quite sure what the direction of the results would go, but I thought that if anything, there would be a signal of benefit. And actually, there was a bit of a signal of harm. It was one of the diets that had the low glycemic index. LDL cholesterol seemed to go up, which is the form of cholesterol that is considered bad.
And were you out on a limb on this, not showing any benefit from glycemic index?
We wrote the grant roughly 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and at that point, I think the research questions were pretty open. And over the years, there's been more accumulating evidence that, yeah, there might not have been as much of a signal as we hoped for. But I think our study is probably one of the strongest to confirm that. And the other issue that comes up all the time now is, what about patients with diabetes? And what about people who are trying to lose weight? Because we didn't include patients with diabetes and we kept weight constant. So I think you can still ask the question, you know, is low glycemic index good for patients with diabetes? Now, one of the things that we're sort of leaning towards is that you get a lot of the benefit of a healthy healthy diet just by following other aspects. A diet that is high in fiber, for example, a diet that is higher in potassium and lower in sodium. My sense is that glycemic index, well, there might be some modest benefit, perhaps, but it shouldn't be organizing our dietary preferences and habits around it.
I think Frank Snacks argues that the categories of food around low glycemic index, it may well be the fiber in them that's the issue, not the...
Yeah, see, this is a common issue with studies of diet or food or nutrients, is that nutrients don't occur in isolation. They're what they call confounding. Nutrients travel together. So typically, most foods that are high in glycemic index are low in fiber, and foods that are low in glycemic tend to be higher in fiber, sort of like the white rice versus brown rice or whole grain. So that's where we sort of think this is going, is that you can get the benefits that we attributed to low glycemic by focusing more on other aspects of diet.
Moving now to obesity, which you've done a lot of research into. You've tried behavioral change, you've tried feeding diets and so on. How would you sum up the state of the art from your research in terms of what you've found?
Doing feeding studies, it's one of my favorite forms of research because you get clean answers.
Our participants, it's not the real world.
It's not the real world, but it tells you what would happen if you consume this diet. What you get with behavioral intervention studies is, well, can you, in the real world, follow a diet? And so individuals have to deal with all of the things that you and I deal with, which is that we go to work and somebody could bring Twinkies, and you might not have access to Clementines unless somebody else decided to bring Clementines. So you're at the whims of your colleagues. Behavioral intervention studies test what an individual can do in their current environment.
So have you found in your research behavioral interventions which look promising?
I have done a fair amount of work on helping people who are overweight or obese try to control their weight. And you do get some benefit from various behavioral interventions.
Such as?
What we typically try to get individuals to do is to, first of all, know where their calories come from, so they actually do what they call food records. So some individuals, it might be sugar-sweetened beverages. Other people, it might be large portion sizes. Other people, it might be frequent eating across the day. And then what you do is, working with a counselor, you identify types of foods, episodes of calorie consumption where you can pull back and where you can make substitutes and do things that are feasible. The challenge is that in order to lose weight, you have to have pretty big calorie deficits. So people typically say in order to lose about a pound every other week, you need to reduce your calorie intake by 500 calories per day. That's a pretty big dent in what somebody consumes. To do that, you really need to track your weight, track your calories. And so we actually embed in most of our interventions now tools to help people self-monitor. Easiest ones to do are weight, which somebody can jump on a scale every day, every other day or so, and track their weight. The other one is sort of minutes of physical activity, which is relatively easy to do. Calorie counting, that's challenging. That takes special efforts because we always don't know how many calories are in any particular item, particularly ones that we purchase, let's say, at a restaurant. The other thing that we do is we try to have some type of continued intervention, because weight loss interventions are not just something that just sort of you give it and it's over. It really requires some efficient way to sort of continue it with fairly frequent contact, but doing it efficiently. So in our most recent trial, we used a website where people had to log their self-monitoring data on weight, physical activity, and calorie counts, and then they got semi-automated feedback related to their behavior. Feedback could be, haven't been to the website, you know, come back because we haven't seen you for 2 weeks, or great, your weight's going down, keep up the good work. So instead of having a person either meet you or call you, you have some sort of inexpensive approach to sort of keep you engaged over time, which we think is really important.
A digital monkey on your shoulder.
Yeah, or spouse, the digital spouse.
And very quickly, a huge problem in Australia, which is damage to your kidneys, which can affect your health profoundly.
Yeah, that's another area of my interest. So I try to look for interventions that are modifiable. And so I've been interested in diet, physical activity. With kidney disease, it's probably a mixture of modifiable as well as genetic.
You accumulate this, it's aging, it's heart, it's arterial disease, it's drugs, it's all sorts of things that accumulate kidney damage as you get older and increase your risk of heart attacks and strokes.
Aging represents the cumulative burden of exposures or bad things that have happened to us over time. So if we're consuming foods that damage, you know, our arteries, our kidneys over time, that'll progress. Now, what I was getting at is that there are certain people that, particularly African Americans, who have a genetic variant called APOL1 that's present in roughly 15-20% of African Americans. And what it seems to do is accelerate kidney disease in those that have some. And we documented that in two studies. And that's a very important finding because I think, as I think in Australia, African Americans or blacks in the U.S. have a tremendously high, disproportionately high risk of end-stage kidney disease. Now, I don't want to dismiss the effects of diet. There have been other investigators who have focused on diets rich in fruits and vegetables. And there might be a benefit in terms of what we call acid-base balance, where we're providing some what we call bicarbonate, which is a base, that actually helps to preserve kidney function. It's early evidence. I think there's a good signal there. But there's something going on. I can tell you that just in this community around Hopkins, very high prevalence of chronic kidney disease, proteinuria, which is a manifestation of kidney disease. And many of us think that it's something about the environment, and I personally think it's an adverse diet that is actually contributing to it.
And you've looked at the controlling blood pressure as a way of helping?
In order to understand the effect of blood pressure control on kidney function, you have to conduct long-term studies. So we had one study called ASK, African American Study of Kidney Disease and Hypertension, where people who had some amount of proteinuria in their urine at baseline got benefit from having a more rigorous or lower blood pressure goal. And
actually, they've shown in Australian Aboriginal people, Torres Strait Islanders, of intensive blood pressure control in one of the islands in the north of Australia.
Would be consistent with what we've found here. Blood pressure control, I think, is critically important, and even though there's some controversy about what the goal blood pressure would be, I think for somebody who has kidney disease with some protein in their urine, which is a risk factor, I would definitely use a lower blood pressure goal, let's say 120, 80, rather than 140, 90 as a target, as a means to retard kidney disease progression.
And you won't do yourself any harm by going on a healthy diet.
One of the other areas we haven't talked about is phosphorus. This is a really, I think, a hot and interesting area of science. Many of the products that we consume, particularly processed foods, are high in phosphorus intake. Colas, for example, are high in phosphorus. And we're doing a study to find out if low versus high phosphorus intake affects proteinuria. Our hypothesis is that a high phosphorus intake will increase proteinuria. And that could be, you know, again, a manifestation of a bad diet, somebody who consumes lots of sodas as opposed to other types of beverages.
And so does a low phosphorus diet correlate with a healthy, you know, what we traditionally know as a healthy diet?
Yes, you know, in many respects, a lot of the phosphorus that we consume is just additives. It's part of some of the preservatives that are in food, sometimes the coloring agents and stuff like this. So it's just, but it hasn't gotten a lot of attention. It's often not even measured in the food products. And so you go to a food label and you won't see it, at least in the United States. So I think this is a really interesting area, probably overlooked. It might be one of those nutrients that in retrospect we should have spent more time on.
Professor Larry Apple is director of the Welsh Centre for Prevention at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Needless to say, the study has generated a lot of criticism from the Sydney group, which helped develop the glycemic index. But their critique has been refuted by the US researchers.